I'd like to introduce this afternoon's speaker from Los Angeles, California, Jin G. Let's give a real warm welcome.
Hi, my name is Jin and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'm delighted to be here today. I think this is just wonderful what your day of sobriety is, as you coined the phrase here. I think it's just a fabulous thing. I know there have been a lot of occasions for me where I didn't feel like going to a meeting was enough. I really felt like I needed a convention. And I think that's what you guys are having today, something like that. And I think it's just terrific. I'm so delighted that you would invite me to be a part of it. I was thinking too, you know, I thought, it amazes me, just the different things that occur in my life today. You know, I had never really left Los Angeles when I first came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I grew up in a little town called Venice, just out in Los Angeles, right at the beach there. And the first time that I ran away, I made it 6 miles east of the ocean. And that was about the closest thing to a geographic that I ever took. So I really didn't travel a whole lot, you know. And I was thinking about, isn't it neat that Alcoholics Anonymous made it possible for me to come however many miles it is to be up here in Northern California, something that I had never experienced before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And yet during the time that I've been in the program, I've been invited up here a few times, and I've made some friends, and I've gotten a chance to see a lot of them today. I think it's just wonderful. I think Alcoholics Anonymous is just fascinating. You know, in the last few years, the thing for me that's been so special about Alcoholics Anonymous that I think about so much at the different meetings that I'm attending or the different friends that are in my life, and as I think about my sponsors in my life, think about what it talks about in the book, that we are people who normally would not mix. And I thought about that today as I sat here and I watched each of the newcomers stand up and introduce themselves. And I don't know any of you, and you, of course, probably don't know anything about my life, but I thought, you know, there really is a very likely chance that many of us would never have mixed in an organization or in a group such as we are today, and I think it's really terrific that Alcoholics Anonymous makes that possible. It's been one of the highlights in my life over the years. I'd like to welcome those of you who are new or might be visiting Alcoholics Anonymous and this meeting today. I want you to know that I'm not an authority on Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not paid to get up here and share my story. And of course, when I'm done, you'll probably say, thank God they didn't have to pay her for that. But I've been asked to get up here and tell you a little bit about my experience, strength, and hope. I happen to believe that I was born an alcoholic, and I don't care to get into any kind of philosophical discussion about whether that's the case or not. It's a belief that I have, and the reason for that is that there was something wrong with me before I ever started to drink. And the way that that first manifested itself in me was at the age of 5 years old, I became obsessed with the idea of suicide, and at that time I started to try and kill myself. And when I was 5, I started to cut my hands and fingers and wrists with razor blades, and I started to take overdoses of baby aspirin. The idea of suicide for me was one that never left until after I'd been in Alcoholics Anonymous for some time. Really, it wasn't as though I walked through the doors and then it left. It was more a long-term process for me, and I don't remember specifically when it was. But up until the time that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I can assure you that there was never a day that I can recall that I didn't try and take my life, that I didn't do something to put myself in a position where someone else might take my life, or I didn't pray to God that He would please just let me out. Just let me die. It was the thing that I wanted the most. Obviously, I wasn't successful at that. I happen to believe that the thing that made it possible for me to exist for as long as I did without having to be incarcerated in some kind of a mental institution was the fact that at 7 years old, I was introduced to drugs, and shortly thereafter, I found alcohol. I started to drink on a regular basis when I was 8 years old. I found my combination not too long after that, which was barbiturates or reds or yellows or downers, whatever you might know them as, and alcohol. And I very rarely used one of those without the other, because the combined effect of those got me where I wanted to go. And I wasn't a party girl. I wasn't a social drinker. I drank for one reason only, not to feel anything at all. I wanted complete oblivion. And when I drank and I took those kind of pills, that's what I got. It made me not feel. It made me not care. And that's all that I wanted, and that's the only reason, I think, really, that I didn't have to be locked up. Because it always just hurt so much for me out there, you know. I know when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would mention the fact that I had taken pills as well as, you know, done a lot of drinking, there were some people, and they'd come up to me and say, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's for pure alcoholics. And I was really confused. I mean, I just didn't know what to do, you know. And then I later found out that the only people who really care about people mentioning that they've taken pills before they got here are the ones who are still taking them in AA. So I think that some of the things that, some of the perceptions that I have about my life today that that have been something that I have felt comfortable with as I look back, you know, there was something wrong with me as a little kid. I mean, I have since found out that a lot of five-year-olds don't go around trying to kill themselves on a daily basis. And I was sent to a lot of psychiatrists. Not a lot, that's not true. I was sent to some psychiatrists and some psychologists before coming to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really can't tell you what their diagnosis was of me because I never told them anything. I always thought that they should work for their money and they weren't going to get any help from me, you know, so that was the way that I attended that sort of therapy. But anyway, I've looked back on my life at that time, and because they've been old ideas that I've had to work through in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But to give you the way that I saw the world as I was growing up, I noticed that there were men and women. I was a very observant little kid. And as I recall, up until the time I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I do not recall a man showing any emotion whatsoever, with the exception of anger and rage. I do not ever remember seeing a man cry or show any form of grief or loss at all. The only thing I remember was seeing men get so angry that they had to punch somebody in the face or punch a wall nearby. I thought that that's all men ever felt, was that the only emotion you could ever provoke out of them was anger and rage. The most you could hope for is maybe you could get them to punch you in the face if they really cared about you. But that's really all I thought that they felt or were capable of feeling. On the other hand, although I saw a lot of women in my life reacting with the same type of violence and rage, I knew that they also seemed to feel other things. I saw some of them cry. I even saw a few of them having nervous breakdowns. And I looked at those two different groups of people as I saw it, and I decided immediately which one I wanted to be like. And I spent my life before coming into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be what I thought a man was. And my idea of a man was someone who cared about absolutely no one, who let no one get close, who felt absolutely nothing. And that's the way that I tried to live my life before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not successful at that. In fact, it seemed as though I had absolutely no insulation at all for my emotions. And from the time that I was 5 years old, which is sort of the reckoning point for me that I can recall to, I remember how much pain I always seemed to be in. I remember going to school and having some little kid call me a name and tease me about having curly red hair or being skinny or whatever it was, you know. And I remember how much it hurt inside, how it felt like they'd taken a knife and were cutting up my guts. And I would want to start to cry, you know, and sometimes I did cry. And at that time, I began to hate myself because I knew that the fact that I wanted to show or did show any kind of an emotion because of something else that someone did meant that I was a weak person. And there's nothing in my life I've ever been able to tolerate less in anyone, but most of all myself, than what I consider to be weakness. And so I found out at 5 years old that I was weak, and I never liked anything about myself from that point on. I never liked the way that I looked. I never liked the way that I lived. I never liked anything. Most of all, I never liked the way that I felt for 5 seconds. It was always just too painful for me. And when I was a little kid and they said, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I said, "A boy." And they told me that I couldn't because it wasn't as easy back then as it is now. But that is what I wanted to be for a long, long time. And what I decided was, again, it was my perceptions and the way that I saw the world, but I decided if I couldn't be a boy, that the next best thing, the only possible option for someone like me, was to be a tough broad. And so I spent my time before coming to Alcoholics Anonymous trying to be what I thought a tough broad was. Now, I suppose in some ways that's sort of a geographic concept. You know, I mean, it sort of depends on where you grow up and what area you're hanging out in as what is a tough broad. In Venice, where I grew up, I mean, one of the things that you did was you never wore shoes. It was a beach town, and tough broads did not wear shoes. And we would stand around the beach looking tough, we being my gang, because, of course, you have to be in a gang if you're a tough broad, and I was in a gang. I would stand there, and I would take my cigarette. And, you know, a lot of people would stare at us sometimes, for a variety of reasons. One thing, they thought I had wild hair back then. But anyway, I would take my my cigarette and I would throw it down on the ground and I'd put it out with my bare feet. And then these people, whoever they might be, would kind of turn to one another and poke each other and sort of whisper. And I knew what they were saying. They were saying, "Wow, hey, that is one tough broad." And it wasn't until after I'd been sober for a while that my sponsor said, "You know, what they might have been saying was, did you see that? That person just put flesh to fire. Why would anybody do anything so stupid, you know?" But I didn't see it that way. The way that I saw it was that it was tough. I thought that you would think it was tough, and so I was more than willing to step on lit cigarette butts on a regular basis. I in fact, was willing to go to any length
to prove that I was tough. I suppose I was trying really hard to prove to you that I was tough because I never really was very successful at proving to the most important person, as I see it and saw it then. I never really convinced myself that I was tough. I suppose if I could encapsulate what I wanted more than anything in the world, I wanted the ability to walk in a room and have everybody back away from me in terror. Now, when you're this size, that very rarely happens. But it is what I wanted, and it's what I strove for, and I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. And I overcompensated in some ways, as I suppose some of us do. I've already told you the type of chemicals that I use, and I really don't have a very exciting story to share with you. I mean, if you used barbiturates and alcohol as I did, then you know that not only did you not do much, you weren't capable of doing much. And I didn't. You know, I overdosed, I threw up, I blacked out, and passed out, and that's really my story. And I didn't do it for as long as an awful lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous did. In growing up and hanging out with my gang, being a tough broad, one of our important sidelines was the fact that we were thieves. I began stealing at the age of 5 years old, and I never felt bad about stealing. Basically the way I looked at it, which was actually the case, was that anything that I ever stole from anyone in my neighborhood had already been stolen by them, and so it just was kind of keeping everything moving. I made it a point to only steal from people who trusted me. I mean, they had to trust you enough to let you in their door, or you couldn't really steal anything. Anyway, we also had a business, this gang, and most of us were all on welfare, and most of the people in our neighborhood were as well. And when their checks were coming, you know, and there were a few days off, everybody would be kind of low on money, and so my gang and I would go to the store, and we would steal whatever food items these people needed, and when they would get their welfare checks, they would pay us half price for whatever items we had stolen. And that was our business, to make our money. Well, we would all go to the store. There were 5 gang members and myself. We would all go to the store. We would all load up the bags together. But I want you to know that not on any occasion that I can recall did anyone carry the bags out of the store but me. I always carried the bags out of the store. Now, my sponsor and I had a long discussion about this after I had been sober. I explained to him. It was very clear. I didn't even think I had to explain it. But I did, because he was very slow to understand certain things about the streets. But I explained to him, the reason I carried the bag out of the store was because the gang got together, they said, hey, who is the best thief? All right? It's June. I mean, there's no question about it. And so we are going to give her the honor of always carrying the bag out of the store. Now, my sponsor had this really weird perception about this whole thing. He sort of thought it was more along the lines of them saying, if somebody has to go, it might as well be her. And that's why I got to carry the bags out of the store. Anyway, I wandered along out there. My mother had been in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for about 7 years by the time I first came to a meeting. I didn't come to a meeting because I wanted help. I didn't come to a meeting because I'd asked for help. I was forced to come to the meeting by my mother. And I sat in the meeting, and I certainly did not raise my hand. Because if there's anything in the world I hated almost as much as myself, not more, but almost as much, it was my mother, who was also an alcoholic. And I know all about alcoholism. You know, I knew all about it then. I knew all about the broken promises. I knew all about the violence and the bars and just everything that was going on in my life, you know, firsthand about alcoholism. I knew I was never going to admit to being weak and disgusting like my mother was. I was not going to be an alcoholic. And here I found myself sitting in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I was not very happy about it, and I refused to raise my hand or really pay any attention at all. Were it not for the fact that a miracle began in my life that night, even though I didn't get sober. And what that was for me was there was a guy sitting in that meeting that I admired more than anyone else in the entire world. And I admired him for lots of reasons. I don't even know if I can remember all of them really to tell you, but some of them were the fact that Paul had been in prison, he had tattoos, he carried a knife, he rode a motorcycle, he was extremely violent, and everyone in my neighborhood was afraid of him. And I saw this guy, he was everything I ever wanted to be. And I looked at him and I thought to myself, I thought, wow, I just never thought people that great came to AA, you know? And then I went out and I got drunk the next night. I wasn't that impressed, but it really meant a lot to me, you know? And I came back to some meetings after that night, and I went to meetings for about 2 weeks. I followed Paul to all the meetings that Paul was going to, and he was brand new then. He was going to lots and lots of meetings. And so I went to lots and lots of meetings. I wasn't raising my hand. I didn't have a problem. I was just following Paul around. And in between the meetings, I would explain to Paul that I wasn't an alcoholic, of course, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic. I mean, after all, I was nothing like my mother, and I was far too young to be an alcoholic, you know? And then I had places to go and people to see and things to do. I had my whole life ahead of me, and I just couldn't possibly
be an alcoholic. Now, I later found out that people who are non-alcoholics don't have to spend any time trying to convince people that they're not alcoholic. They already know that, you know, but I didn't know that then, and so I spent all this time trying to convince Paul. And he finally turned to me and he said, June, they tell me in Alcoholics Anonymous that we can't diagnose anybody's disease but our own. He said, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception. But I happen to believe you're an alcoholic. I've seen the way that you drink, and I've seen the way that you use chemicals. And I happen to believe that if you don't come into this program and take what these people have to offer you within a period of 6 months or less, you're going to be out on the streets, you're going to be shooting stuff, and you're going to be selling your ass. And he wasn't trying to scare me. He wasn't trying to dramatize anything about what was going on out there. He was talking about some things that had happened to him, some things that had happened and were beginning to happen to me. And I thought a little bit about what he was saying, and I started to raise my hand in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And at that time, I think that perhaps in certain of the meetings that I attended, there were some people who weren't aware of the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. In particular, the third tradition, which states that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. And the reason I think they might not have known about that tradition is because some people came up to me at some of those meetings when I started to raise my hand, and they told me that I was too young, that I couldn't possibly be an alcoholic at my age, and that they didn't want a little kid sitting around their meetings while they were talking about serious things. And they told me if I came back to their meeting, they'd throw me out. And, you know, by the time I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, probably as most of us have, I had been thrown out of every place that I had been. I didn't have any choices, and I just thought Alcoholics Anonymous didn't want me either. By the time I started to raise my hand in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been up to that point living with my mother. And as I've already told you, I really wasn't very fond of my mother. In fact, she was one of the few people that I used to react on a regular basis violently towards. And during this period of time, I had attacked her on a couple of occasions, and she was getting sober, and she didn't think she had to be subjected to that kind of behavior in sobriety any longer. She threw me out of her house, and I left. My family hadn't talked to me for 3 years at that time. I was not allowed to call or come by under any circumstances, and so I didn't try. I'd been in a lot of foster homes, maybe five or six up to that point. I'd been thrown out of all of them, and none of them would take me back. I tried to get into various rehab and alcohol and drug recovery homes in the Los Angeles area, and none of them would take me, some because of my age and some just because of my attitude. I tried to get into a program in Santa Monica called Synanon, and they wouldn't take me, and that's pretty bad, really, because Synanon will take almost anyone. And then I thought, well, you know what, at least I have my gang, and that's really all that matters. And then one day as I walked down an alley, my gang beat me up. And so I found myself sitting in meetings at Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 87 pounds. I had the clothes I had on. I didn't have any shoes. I wouldn't have worn them if I had had them at that time. But I didn't have any, and I didn't have any money. I didn't have any friends, family, place to live. I had absolutely nothing. And when they told me that I wasn't welcome in Alcoholics Anonymous, when a few of these individuals said that, I fell back on the same answer I'd been falling back on since I was 5 years old. It was my number one answer, really. And I went over to a friend of my mother's, and I went into her bathroom, which is the first place I went at anyone's house I ever visited. I found the kind of pills that I needed, and I took an overdose. And before I passed out that day, I went to a noon meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by the time I got to the meeting, all I could do was lay down. I couldn't sit. It was just impossible. And so I laid in the meeting. And it's interesting because I've been sober for a while now in West Los Angeles. I don't ever remember anybody getting called on to participate that was laying in the meeting. But for some reason that day, they called on me. Now, I certainly don't know what I said. The next thing I know, I woke up in a hospital. Apparently, I said enough so that they knew that I needed to be taken to a hospital. And when I came to, the doctor was giving me medication to make me throw up and explaining to me that the pills I had taken were to slow down my heart. And had I been there 5 or 10 minutes later, I would have been in a coma that they probably couldn't have brought me out of. And I don't know why that overdose was any different than any of the others I inflicted upon myself during the time that I was out there. I just know that it was. I know that because I haven't taken anything that affects me from the neck up since that time, and that's how I define sobriety. I celebrated 12 years of continuous sobriety the 13th of this July of this year. I think I know what I was trying to say in that meeting, and most of the time when I'm asked to participate in a meeting, it's something that I try and remember to say. I think no matter how incoherent it actually was, whatever I said, I think I was trying to say something like this. You know what? I don't know if I've gone as far as some of you people have. And then again, maybe I've gone a little bit farther than some of you. But I don't really think that that's the point here. Because the point is, I don't have any place left to go. And I don't know if I want what you people have. I don't even know what you have. I just know I can't stand what I've got anymore. And you don't have to tell me if I go back out there on the streets I'm going to die. Because dying doesn't scare me. Dying is what I've been trying to do since I was 5 years old. What scares me is maybe I can go out there and live. If for another 20 or 30 years like some of you people have. And that's what I can't stand. I can't stand living out there that way anymore. So please let me stay. And the people of Alcoholics Anonymous have let me stay. And I've had to do the things that have been necessary for me to stay. And in many ways, they're the same for all of us. And in other ways, they're different, you know. And I don't mean to say that after I started to raise my hand and I actually became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous that there weren't still people who thought I was too young. That would not be true if I said that. You know, there were people who'd come up to me after meetings and they'd say, you know, kid, I spilt more booze on my tie than you ever drank. And I turned to them and I said, you know, if you hadn't spilt so much, maybe you would have gotten here sooner. I think that one of the most interesting things for me, as I look back on the early time of my sobriety, it's really the condition that I arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous in. And I've already told you that I was a failure in every area when I arrived in this program. I didn't have as many areas as a lot of other people maybe, but I'd failed in all those that I had. And I sat in those meetings, and there were an awful lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that extended a kind hand and a kind word, and I could not and I would not accept it. No, I didn't want anybody to hug me or touch me or shake my hand. I did not accept rides in Alcoholics Anonymous. I walked or I hitchhiked. I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day when I came to this program, and nobody ever lit my cigarettes. I lit them all myself. If you wanted to hold a match, you were welcome to hold it as long as you would like. But you would not light my cigarette with it. And after I'd been sober for a little while, I took up smoking cigars and a pipe. And I continued to wear my motorcycle jacket that on the back said, "Do unto others," and then split. And my motorcycle chains. And I hung on to my black eye and various battle scars for quite a while, those first few weeks at least. And I had a very limited vocabulary when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It consisted almost solely of profanity. I mean, I didn't even know what profanity meant when I came here, but I found out that I did in a different manner. But it was all that I really knew. I just had a few other words, the and, you know, mother, just a couple. And I found that there were a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous at certain groups that were very offended by that kind of language. And so I made it a point to go there and use it a lot around them. Now, what I found was that by acting in that manner, and I can assure you that it's probably not that different here, if you choose to act in that manner, that you too can sit in a meeting almost this size and have an entire row all to yourself. Because there were a whole lot of people that just didn't want anything to do with my kind of behavior, and I certainly don't blame them. But I was fortunate enough to find a couple of sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I think about my sponsors, one of them in particular, I again think about that line in the book where it says that we are people who normally would not mix. First of all, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and for a long time after I was here, I don't know exactly how long, but for a while, I did not listen to women speakers. I didn't like women. I didn't like any women. I didn't like me. I didn't like my mother. And I didn't like any other women that would be in Alcoholics Anonymous because I figured they had to be like one or the other of us. So I didn't want anything to do with women. I didn't want to listen to them talk at the podium. They had nothing to say to me. I was not a woman. I was a tough broad. And so I just would shut them off. And actually, when I think about that, it always makes me feel better when I'm asked to share in a meeting that seems kind of big and I'm real nervous because I think there's got to be some other tough broads out there who are not going to listen to me because they think, hey, what does she have to say to me? Plus, there's got to be some guys out there who think that no broad has anything that could, you know, to say that they could ever listen to. And so I figure there's really not as many people listening to me as it looks like. Anyway, I just didn't like women, and I was afraid of men. The only men I'd ever known in my life were alcoholics who beat up women, and I knew that all the men I'd be meeting in these meetings were alcoholics, and I figured that meant that they beat up women too, and they scared me. Now, I don't know about here in Northern California, but in L.A. where I got sober, all we have in A.A. are men and women, and I didn't want anything to do with any of them, you know. But I kept coming around anyway, and I found a sponsor, and Jeff became one of my first sponsors, and actually I think he became my very first sponsor, and he was from a similar background as I was. He had a sort of a hostile attitude at times as well. And when Jeff thought I was getting out of hand and I'd gone a little bit too far, either in my behavior or my cigar smoking or whatever it might be, he would grab me around the neck and he would threaten to kill me. Now, I haven't found that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was something that I understood at that time, And I know I'm very grateful that Jeff became my sponsor then. I also found this other sponsor, and this is what's amazing is that this was a woman. I got a woman sponsor. That's just amazing, you know. And part of the reason I got this sponsor was I was going to 21 meetings a week throughout most of my first year of sobriety. And it seemed to me as though Gail Wilson talked at about 18 of those meetings every week. And I thought to myself, perhaps if I ask her to be my sponsor, I can find out where she's speaking and I won't have to go listen to her all the time. And that's how Gail became my sponsor. Now, I would go to meetings and Gail would see me and she would come up to me and she would say, "Do not, absolutely do not sit next to me at the meeting. I can't take the cigar smoke and I don't want you to sit next to me." And she said, and not only that, she said, "Please, please do not tell anyone that I am your sponsor." And I knew that she meant it, you know. And I didn't tell a lot of people that Gail was my sponsor. Because really, Gail was a lady, you know, or along that line. And not only did she not use the words that I used, she didn't know what some of the words I was using meant. It really wasn't very good for my image as a tough broad for people to know I was associating with someone like her. So Gail and I would secretly meet after meetings and talk about the program. But anyway, I got very active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because both Gail and Jeff were very active and they insisted that I be. You know, when I arrived in this program, physically I really wasn't in that bad of shape. I mean, compared to so many people that I've since met. But mentally, I think I was up there with about the best of them. You know, I'd come in and they made me greeter at the door at one of the meetings in the West Side. And I would stand there, my motorcycle jacket and chains and cigars, welcoming the newcomers as they came in. Then they'd walk up and say, "My name is Kathy," and I'd say, "I'm June." And somebody else would walk in and say, "My name's Mary," and I'd say, "Hi, I'm Kathy," because all I could remember was the last thing that I'd heard. That's all that was up there, you know. And it's funny because people who know me now just don't believe that I wasn't capable of carrying on conversations, but I really couldn't, you know. I'd be standing there and I'd be looking at someone for a while, and then I'd say, "Bird." And that was all. And I heard music the first 6 months I was sober, whether the radio was on or not. But I never told anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous that because I knew that they would lock me up. You know, I knew it meant that I had just gone too far, you know, and my mind was just gone. And I didn't want them to lock me up. And then I heard this woman, she got up and she took like a 9-month shift and she talked about the fact that, you know, during the first 6 months she was sober, she'd heard music, whether she was listening to the radio or not. And I thought, wow, we've probably been listening to the same station, you know. Anyway, my home group, the Monday Night Venice group, what they would do is after the meeting is they'd say, if you're new to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's very important that you get the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's going to tell you what this program is all about. And they'd say, now, we don't make any profit selling that book. We sell it for exactly what it costs this group. But if you're new and you don't have a lot of money, that's the way most of us got here. And so you can take that book for no money down and nothing a week, you know, until you get on your feet. And then they'd throw in at my group, not all the meetings, but mine, they'd say, and if you're too afraid to talk to us, you can just steal it. And I thought, hey, just because I'm quitting drinking, I don't see any reason why I have to quit stealing, too. I mean, let's not get drastic, you know. And so I thought about it for a while. I thought, yeah, but if I steal a big book from an AA meeting, it might jinx my sobriety. And so what I did was I went to the library in Santa Monica, and I stole the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And while I was there, I picked up a copy of the 12 and 12. I didn't see any reason to make two trips. And I never felt bad about that. You know, I thought the library has lots of books. And I didn't hide the fact that I'd stolen those books. I called my sponsor that night, Jeff, and I was thinking about this. I gave Jeff a cake for 15 years a few months back, and I was thinking about that day when I called him up, and I said, "Hi, Jeff, I stole the big book today." And I remember he didn't say, "You know, June, we don't steal anymore now that we're in Alcoholics Anonymous." I remember he said, "That's great, kid, you got the book," you know. And he knew that that's where he had to start with someone like me. I ended up a few years later, I needed to make an amends for that. I loaded up that book and the 12 and 12 and about 50 other books that I had stolen since I was 6 years old. Great classics like Misty the Seahorse, the kind of things you steal when you're 6 and 7 years old. And I took them down to the local library and I explained to her that I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that it was necessary for my sobriety to return those books. I asked her if it'd be all right if I made payments, however, because they wanted 3 to 5 cents a day and I'd had some of the books for 11 years. And
She said that would be funny. It was really funny. She goes, you know, she said, I used to work in this library in Laguna Beach. This man came in, he said the same thing you just said. He'd had this book for 37 years. She says, you guys must do this all the time. When I got to this program, I had a seventh grade education, and I stayed on a lot of different people's couches and in cars. After I'd been sober for, I don't know, somewhere in my first year, I found a garage that I could rent for $40 a month, and that's where I lived for a while. And I was unable mentally and unwilling, as far as attitude-wise, to go back to school, any kind of normal school, despite the fact that my sponsors thought that was what I should do. But I just couldn't. And so what I did was I went to lots and lots of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got a job working in an answering service, which was wonderful for me because I could work very flexible hours and get to lots and lots of meetings. But after I'd been sober for a while, I got an opportunity to go to a college. It was a specific college. It was for business school, and I could learn to be a secretary. Now, if there's anything in my life that I never wanted to learn to be, it was a secretary. But my sponsor said that's what I was going to learn to be. And so I went to this school. I started out typing 17 words a minute with 9 errors. And I went to school and I typed one day at a time for 14 months. At the end of that time, I could type 37 words a minute with 19 errors. And they told me that I wasn't secretarial material. Of course, I could have told them that, you know, that nobody wanted to listen to me. Anyway, when I finished that school, they suggested I take a test which would give me an equivalent to a high school diploma, a test called a GED. And I went ahead and I took that test. And now it was time for me to go out there and look for a job. And at that point in time, it was one of the most difficult periods I had had in my sobriety up until that time. And I mentioned earlier the fact that I hated myself from the time that I was 5 years old. I honestly believe that those feelings about myself were what actually drove me through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just couldn't stand living that life out there that way with me, the way that I was living it, you know. And when I got into the program, that had a lot to do with the why I didn't want anybody to touch me or get close to me or sit next to me, because I felt like throwing up every time I touched myself or saw myself in the mirror. And I knew that that's how you would feel too if you ever got to know me. And so I wanted to just keep all of you, everybody in fact, away, as far away as I possibly could. And I would sit in those meetings and I would listen to people share. And they would share about the fact that when they came into this program, they couldn't look anybody in the eye, and they didn't want to look in mirrors because they hated themselves so much. But that at some period of time in their sobriety, and it varied with each and every one of them that I heard share, they had come to a point where they had liked themselves, where they could walk down the street and look anybody in the eye, and they felt equal with the rest of the human race. And I would sit there and I would think, no, that's just not possible for someone like me. You don't know where I've been, and you don't know the things that I've done and who I've done them to. It's never going to be possible that that will happen. But maybe, if I keep coming to lots of these meetings and I try and do what it's suggested that we do in this program, maybe someday I won't feel like throwing up when I look in a mirror. And for that, I kept coming back, just so I wouldn't have to feel like throwing up all the time at what I was. And that was the hope for me. And when I finished this business college and it was time to go out there and look for a job, the reason it was so hard for me was because I still knew I was a dirty little Venice brat. I knew that's all I had ever been and that's all I was going to be. I didn't know how to be anything else. I didn't know how to dress like other people did. I didn't know how to talk like other people did. I didn't know anything about wearing makeup. I didn't know how often people were supposed to brush their teeth or wash their hair or take baths. Nobody ever told me any of that stuff, and I didn't know anything about it. And there were some people on the program, a couple of women, and they took me out and they helped me buy a couple of items of clothing, and they gave me a couple of others. And I put those clothes on, it was like Halloween. You know, look at the dirty little Venice bride dressing up like a citizen. I mean, this was not me, you know. And I went out there, and I knew that to them it looked like a costume too, all these places that I interviewed with. And I knew I wasn't as good as those people. I knew I wasn't a citizen type person, but I went ahead and I tried, and I ended up getting a job. I just couldn't believe it. I got hired to work in an insurance company. It was so exciting. I mean, it was so square. I just had to laugh constantly, you know. And I went to work. I tried really hard, and on the seventh day, they called me in the office. And by then, I thought, hey, maybe they're going to give me a raise, you know. And they fired me. She said, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to let you go. You don't have enough experience. And she said, and not only that, dear. She said, you don't seem to have any common sense whatsoever.
Now, I didn't know what common sense was, but I knew I was being insulted. And I went across the street and I called the Los Angeles Central Office. And I said, hello, this is June. I'm a member. I'm sober. And I've just been fired. Now, what are you going to do about that? And they just laughed. I couldn't believe it. I thought we'd picket or something. You know. I mean, I couldn't believe we were just going to sit back and let them fire sober AA members. Come on, you know. Well, that's what they told me they were going to do. And, I remember I called my sponsor that night. I told him, I said, you know, I never got fired before I came to AA. And he reminded me I'd never had a job. Anyway, now I had to go out and look for another job. And that certainly didn't do a lot for my confidence, but I went ahead and I tried. And one day, I don't remember how this happened. I think somebody on the program sent me on this interview, but I found myself filling out an application in a bank. I thought that was particularly amusing. I'd never even been in a bank up to that point, but for a thief, it's always interesting to have access to that kind of a place. And I sat there and I went ahead and I was filling it out, and it got to the point in the application where it says, due to the fact that as a bank employee, it's necessary that you be bonded, we're going to do a thorough background check. And I thought, oh no, not me. I don't want anybody looking into my background. You know, I mean, they call one library and I've had it. And I thought, no, come on, you know, let's go ahead and fill it out and leave the results up to God. And I did. And they called me back on a series of interviews. Not only did they hire me to work in the bank, they put me to work in the vault. And I didn't even know if the program worked that good, I'll tell you. But it did. I didn't take anything while I worked there. And somewhere along the line at that period of time, I ended up deciding that I wanted to go back to school. And I started taking a couple of night classes at a college and working full-time. And eventually I got a job on campus and I was able to rearrange my schedule and started going to school full-time and working full-time. And I just did that one day at a time. And I found myself after 3 years, they called me into the office and they said that I had completed the requirements for what they called an AA college degree. I thought that was a great name for a degree. But it just amazed me, you know. I'd never wanted a college degree. I mean, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, he had said, hey, would you like a college degree or a switchblade? I mean, there wasn't even an issue there, you know. I never knew anybody with a college degree, and I certainly didn't want one. It just didn't go with my my goals in life. And yet at that time and today, it's something that that I was glad that Alcoholics Anonymous has made possible in my life. And when I went up there to get my diploma that day, they announced that I was graduating third in my class out of 485 students. And how is that possible, you know? I thought, this is the same person that when I came to meetings, you know, I used to have to stand at the door and I couldn't remember which name was mine, you know? And here I was able to just go to school one day at a time, and Alcoholics Anonymous made that possible in my life. Anyway, I went ahead and I continued going on to school, and I finished college a few years back, and somewhere along the line I'd come up with this dream, and I honestly cannot remember when I had come up with it, but I went ahead and I did the footwork for that dream, and I received a telegram maybe 4.5 years ago now, something like that, telling me that I had been chosen out of 3,000 applicants as one of 300 to go to law school. Now, when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I always had planned on spending a lot of time in court, but never on that side of the table. And it's been an interesting journey these past few years as I've been attending law school. I learned, I mean, just so many different things. You know, one of the things I learned was in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have gotten a sense of humor. I mean, when I came to this program, I did not have a sense of humor at all. I can't remember laughing at anything, particularly if it had anything to do with my life. It was not funny, you know, and I did not appreciate anyone else laughing about it either because it absolutely was not funny. And today, I think one of the greatest gifts I've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous is the ability to laugh at some of the tragedies that have occurred in my life. And I found myself, anyway, learning that not everybody necessarily has the same viewpoint. I remember talking to this one guy at law school, and this guy was really square. He was from, you know, down behind the Orange Curtain in Orange County. And we're talking about this movie called The Rose. And This guy's sort of telling me that he told me he really liked this movie, you know, and it's all about Janis Joplin. And this just really surprised me. I mean, here he is, you know, he's from Orange County. He's got a mother and father. I mean, it wasn't his fault, you know. It's just the way it happened for him. But I tried not to hold it against him. But we're standing there, and we're talking, and he goes, you know, he says, I really loved that movie. And I said, really? And he says, yes. He says, in fact, I've always idolized Janis Joplin. And I said, really? And he says, yeah. He said, but there's something about that movie that really bothered me. I said, what was that? And he says, well, there's this one part in the movie where she's about to have an affair with this man. And she turns to him, and she says, well, I have a confession to make. He said, when I was in high school, I slept with the entire high school football team. And so this guy at law school, he turns to me and he says, you know, if that's true about Janis, I just don't think I could ever respect her again. And I looked at him and I said, you mean you'd hold one football team against a girl? And he didn't talk to me for a couple of years. I mean, I didn't even go to high school. Anyway, I went ahead and I attended law school one day at a time, and during the early part of 1983, I learned that my sponsor, Gail Wilson, was dying of cancer. And Gail was 48 years old, and I was scheduled to graduate in May of that year, and it was very obvious that Gail would not live until May of that year. And so during those last few months, I spent a lot of time hanging out with Gail over at the hospital. And a lot of interesting things happened for both of us, I think, during that period of time. I remember just, well, one of the things that would happen was whenever any of the doctors or nurses would come into Gail's room to treat them, she always insisted on introducing me. I mean, these people had no interest in, you know, in meeting me or knowing anything about my life, but Gail insisted, and she said, to whoever they were, said, I want you to meet Junie. She said, Junie's like a daughter to me, and she's going to be an attorney. And I thought about that then, and I think about it so much now. I think, isn't it amazing? This is the same woman that that used to say, don't sit next to me at the meeting, and don't tell anyone that I am your sponsor, you know? And here it is, 11 years later, she wants to introduce me to strangers and tell them I'm like her daughter. And I don't know how that happens. And, you know, one of the things that we talked about so much was Alcoholics Anonymous, of course. She said that, you know, she said, Jane, I got to tell you. She said, I would have given up on you. You were one of the people that I would have given up on, you know, when you came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I remember when you first came to me, you were a couple years sober, and you said you were going to start taking a couple night classes at college. And she said, I just thought this kid will never make it through 2 weeks of school, let alone a whole semester. She said, and then I remember even when you took a couple classes, you said something about someday you wanted to go on to law school. She said, I honestly had to force myself to not laugh out loud, you know. Because she said, I thought with your background and your attitude, you were going absolutely nowhere. She said, but Alcoholics Anonymous never gave me the option of making that judgment and deciding that you couldn't go anywhere or be anything. And I don't blame Gail for, you know, for not believing in me. I mean, I really don't with my behavior and some of which I've described for you today. I don't blame her, you know. But I know what she's talking about, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous, how it's really not my position, nor was it hers, to decide that I could or could not make it or do something that I wanted to do. I know that when I was coming out close to graduation that Gail was so grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous had been able to do that in my life, and I'm so glad that I was able to let it, you know. Gail passed away in April, and I graduated in May. And then, I'm sure all of you already know this, but I really didn't know that much about it. When you want to practice as an attorney, after you graduate law school, you have to pass a bar examination in whatever state you're interested in practicing in. And so I went ahead and I studied for the California bar exam beginning in May, and I took it in July of last year. I received a telegram in December of last year telling me that I did not pass that examination. And I absolutely could not believe it. I couldn't have spent 5 seconds more studying. I couldn't have done anything else. I had really given it the absolute best that I had, and I didn't make it. And I didn't know what it meant. You know, I knew what it meant in a lot of practical ways. It meant I couldn't get a job. It meant that all the loans that I had taken out were due, and I didn't have any way of paying them back. It meant I didn't have enough money for my rent. And I didn't understand why that happened. And I felt like I'd let everybody else down. I felt like I'd let myself down. And I thought maybe it's not God's will for me to be doing this. And I just didn't know, you know. Actually, my first inclination, and sometimes second and third, is always to give up if it has anything to do with me. And that's why I'm very fortunate for the people that are close to me in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, because giving up, as far as my life is concerned, is not even in their vocabulary, you know. And I explained to them that what this meant was that I was supposed to be a waitress. And they explained to me that what this meant was I was supposed to study and take the examination again. And I didn't see it that way, but I went ahead and I did it. And I studied again for the examination for the next several months. I took the examination in this past February. And in June of this year, I received another telegram, and this one said that I did pass. Having passed and not passed, I prefer passing if it's all the same. And I mention that to God as far as future events might be concerned. I think that one of the things that meant the most to me, really, when I got that letter, I mean, I felt more relief than I did any other feeling. But the second page of the telegram told me that that's just passing the examination doesn't mean you're an attorney. They have another step, naturally. And that being that you have to be sworn in. Of course, that's really just another way of getting $100 or so. But they announced on this second page that my swearing-in ceremony would take place on the 13th of June. And that was Gail's AA birthday. She would have been 21 years sober then. And I thought, you know, so many times over the years, for a lot of different reasons, but I've never really been able to buy Gail a present. You know, I'd save up and I'd get her cards and I'd try and make her something with an egg carton or whatever it was. But I sort of felt like maybe that's why I didn't pass that first time. Maybe so I could give Gail that present. I don't know. I suppose if you had to ask me what's the most amazing thing about my life today, it's that I'm living a life I never wanted. That's the thing that just amazes me all the time. You know, I never wanted to be an attorney. You know, I never wanted to be doing any of the things that I'm doing in my life today. I never wanted any of the people that are in my life today. You know, I've been dating a guy for 3 years now. This guy's never been in jail and he doesn't have any tattoos. I mean, those are absolute prerequisites, you know? I don't even know how this happened. And yet we're having a good time, you know. He came home, I don't know, not too long after we'd first been dating with 2 tickets for Chicago, which is where he's from. He said he wanted to take me home to meet his family. And I thought, isn't that amazing? Here I was when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My own family wouldn't let me in their home. And now here it is. I've just been doing the things I've been asked to do and been taught to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And someone else is so proud of me that they want to introduce me to the most important people in their life. And I just don't know how things like that happen, you know. I didn't ask for that when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't walk in here and say, hey, you know what? I'd really like to meet some guy who'd be really proud of me and take me home to meet his family. I mean, come on, you know. I wanted to be a hooker and get over $100 a half an hour or something. You know, those are my goals. Those aren't such bad goals, but they just don't fit into my life right now. I have a job that I start next week, and it's an interesting job. Actually, the job that I've just had has been very interesting, too. I've been working in criminal defense. And the first few days that I was on the job, I went down to court so I could get familiar with the type of cases that my office was going to be handling. And do you know that during that day, in particular the first day, there wasn't one crime that somebody was charged with that I had not committed as I sat there? And I don't know why I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And a lot of them, you know, were, as everybody knows, alcohol and drug related, a lot of the crimes that they were being charged with, and why I never got charged and I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know why a lot of things happen, you know. I mean, there are days when I sit around and I think, hey, maybe you're not an alcoholic. Maybe that was a teenage phase, you know, sowing your oats. Obviously, you're a very intelligent person. Maybe it really wasn't, you know, any of that alcohol stuff, you know. And then I just have to think about third chapter in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's always what I go to and read whenever I have any doubts or I start to wonder or think crazily as I see it. And I read that chapter and then I think a little bit about some of the people that I grew up with. And I can honestly tell you that there aren't any women that I grew up with today that aren't dead, locked up in some kind of an institution, or out on the streets turning tricks so they can support their habit. Now that's where I'm supposed to be. That's where people like me end up. I don't know about people like you, but I know that's where people like me end up because that's where they're all ending up, you know. And when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never lived in a home that had the gas, the lights, and the phone on all at the same time. That just never happened, you know. And that's the kind of life I'm supposed to be living today. And I'm not living it. And I don't know, you know, I think about it, and I don't think that it's because God likes me better than any of those other women that I used to use and drink with. I don't think it's because I'm any prettier or any smarter than any of them. There's only one difference between me and them. I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd really like to thank the committee and this group and all of you for inviting me down here. I've had a wonderful time, and I'm just so grateful to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're new or you're sitting there and you've been sober for a while, as I have at various times, and you're facing that really black period and it just seems like it's not getting any better and it's not working, I hope you'll hang on so that the miracle will happen in your life. I can't tell you what it is, you know. It's probably not even anything that you want, but I can tell you it is worth it. Thanks.